Ashenden, W. Somerset Maugham. Chapter 7. A Trip to Paris. Ashenden was in the habit of asserting that he was never bored. It was one of his notions that only such persons were as had no resources in themselves, and it was but the stupid that depended on the outside world for their amusement. Ashenden had no illusions about himself, and such success in current letters as had come to him had left his head unturned. He distinguished acutely between fame and the notoriety that rewards the author of a successful novel or a popular play, and he was indifferent to this, except insofar as it was attended with tangible benefits. He was perfectly ready to take advantage of his familiar name to get a better stateroom on a ship than he had paid for, and if a customs house officer passed his luggage unopened because he had read his short stories, Ashenden was pleased to admit that the pursuit of literature had its compensations. He sighed when eager young students of the drama sought to discuss its technique with him, and when gushing ladies tremulously whispered in his ear their admiration of his books, he often wished he was dead. But he thought himself intelligent, and so it was absurd that he should be bored. It was a fact that he could talk with interest to persons commonly thought so excruciatingly dull that their fellows fled from them as though they owed them money. It may be that here he was but indulging the professional instinct that was seldom dormant in him. They, his raw material, didn't bore him any more than fossils bore the geologist. And now he had everything that a reasonable man could want for his entertainment. He had pleasant rooms in a good hotel, and Geneva is one of the most agreeable cities in Europe to live in. He hired a boat and rode on the lake, or hired a horse and trotted sedately, for in that neat and orderly canton, it is difficult to find a stretch of turf where you can have a good gallop along the macadamized roads in the environs of the town. He wandered on foot about its old streets, trying among those gray stone houses so quiet and dignified to recapture the spirit of a past age. He read again with delight Rousseau's Confessions, and for the second or third time tried in vain to get on with La Nouvelle Heloise. He wrote. He knew few people, for it was his business to keep in the background, but he had picked up a chatting acquaintance with several persons living in his hotel, and he was not lonely. His life was sufficiently filled. It was varied, and when he had nothing else to do, he could enjoy his own reflections. It was absurd to think that under these circumstances he could possibly be bored. And yet, like a little lonely cloud in the sky, he did see in the offing the possibility of boredom. There is a story that Louis XIV, having summoned a courtier to attend him in a ceremonial occasion, found himself ready to go as the courtier appeared. He turned to him and, with icy majesty, said, "J'ai failli attendre," of which the only translation I can give, but a poor one, is, "I have but just escaped waiting." So Ashenden might have admitted that he now had just escaped being bored. It might be, he mused, as he rode along the lake on a dappled horse with a great rump and a short neck, like one of those prancing steeds that you see in old pictures. But this horse never pranced, and he needed a firm jab with his spur to break even into a smart trot. It might be, he mused, that the great chiefs of the Secret Service in their London offices, their hands on the throttle of this great machine, led a life full of excitement. They moved their pieces here and there. They saw the pattern woven by the multitudinous threads. Ashenden was lavish with his metaphors. They made a picture out of the various pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. But it must be confessed that for the small fry like himself to be a member of the Secret Service was not as adventurous an affair as the public thought. Ashenden's official existence was as orderly and monotonous as a city clerk's. He saw his spies at stated intervals and paid them their wages. When he could get hold of a new one, he engaged him, gave him his instructions, and sent him off to Germany. He waited for the information that came through and dispatched it. He went into France once a week to confer with his colleague over the frontier and to receive his orders from London. He visited the marketplace on market day to get any message the old butter woman had brought him from the other side of the lake. He kept his eyes and ears open, and he wrote long reports which he was convinced no one read, till having inadvertently slipped a jest into one of them, he received a sharp reproof for his levity. The work he was doing was evidently necessary, but it could not be called anything but monotonous. At one moment, for something better to do, he had considered the possibility of a flirtation with the Baroness von Higgins. He was confident now that she was an agent in the service of the Austrian government, and he looked forward to a certain entertainment in the duel he foresaw. It would be amusing to set his wits against hers. He was quite aware that she would lay snares for him, and to avoid them would give him something to keep his mind from rusting. He found her not unwilling to play the game. She wrote him gushing little notes when he sent her flowers. She went for a row with him on the lake, and letting her long white hand drag through the water, talked of love and hinted at a broken heart. They dined together and went to see a performance, in French, in prose, of Romeo and Juliet. Ashenden had not made up his mind how far he was prepared to go when he received a sharp note from R to ask him what he was playing at. Information had come to hand that he, Ashenden, was much in the society of a woman calling herself the Baroness de Higgins, who was known to be an agent of the Central Powers, and it was most undesirable that he should be on any terms with her but those of frigid courtesy. Ashenden shrugged his shoulders. R did not think him as clever as he thought himself, but he was intrigued to discover what he had not known before, that there was someone in Geneva part of whose duties at all events was to keep an eye on him. There was evidently someone who had orders to see that he did not neglect his work or get into mischief. Ashenden was not a little amused. What a shrewd, unscrupulous old thing was R. He took no risks, he trusted nobody, he made use of his instruments, but high or low, had no opinion of them. Ashenden looked about to see whether he could spot the person who had told R what he was doing. He wondered if it was one of the waiters in the hotel. He knew that R had a great belief in waiters. They had the chance of seeing so much and could so easily get into places where information was lying about to be picked up. He even wondered whether R had got his news from the Baroness herself. It would not be so strange if, after all, she was employed by the Secret Service of one of the Allied nations. Ashenden continued to be polite to the Baroness, but ceased to be attentive. He turned his horse and trotted gently back to Geneva. An ostler from the riding stables was waiting at the hotel door, and slipping out of the saddle, Ashenden went into the hotel. At the desk, the porter handed him a telegram. It was to the following effect. Aunt Maggie, not at all well. Staying at Hotel Lotti, Paris. If possible, please go and see her. Raymond. Raymond was one of R's facetious nom de guerre, and since Ashenden was not so fortunate as to possess an Aunt Maggie, he concluded that this was an order to go to Paris. It had always seemed to Ashenden that R had spent much of his spare time in reading detective fiction, and especially when he was in a good humor, he found a fantastic pleasure in aping the style of the Shilling Shocker. If R was in a good humor, it meant that he was about to bring off a coup, for when he had brought one off, he was filled with depression and then vented his spleen on his subordinates. Ashenden, leaving his telegram with deliberate carelessness on the desk, asked at what time the express left for Paris. He glanced at the clock to see whether he had time to get to the consulate before it closed and secure his visa. When he went upstairs to fetch his passport, the porter, just as the lift doors were closed, called him. "Monsieur has forgotten the telegram," he said. "How stupid of me," said Ashenden. Now Ashenden knew that if an Austrian baroness by any chance wondered why he had so suddenly gone to Paris, she would discover that it was owing to the indisposition of a female relative. In those troublesome times of war, it was just as well that everything should be clear and above board. He was known at the French consulate, and so lost little time there. He had told the porter to get him a ticket, and on his return to the hotel, bathed and changed. He was not a little excited at the prospect of this unexpected jaunt. He liked the journey. He slept well in a sleeping car and was not disturbed if a sudden jolt waked him. It was pleasant to lie a while, smoking a cigarette, and to feel oneself in one's little cabin, so enchantingly alone. The rhythmical sound, as the wheels rattled over the points, was an agreeable background to the pattern of one's reflections. And to speed through the open country in the night made one feel like a star speeding through space. And at the end of the journey was the unknown. When Ashenden arrived in Paris, it was chilly, and a light rain was falling. He felt unshaved, and he wanted a bath and clean linen, but he was in excellent spirits. He telephoned from the station to R and asked how Aunt Maggie was. "I'm glad to see that your affection for her was great enough to allow you to waste no time in getting here," answered R, with the ghost of a chuckle in his voice. "She's very low, but I'm sure it'll do her good to see you." Ashenden reflected that this was the mistake the amateur humorist, as opposed to the professional, so often made. When he made a joke, he harped on it. The relations of the joker to his joke should be as quick and desultory as those of a bee to its flower. He should make his joke and pass on. There's of course no harm if, like the bee, approaching the flower, he buzzes a little, for it's just as well to announce to a thick-headed world that a joke is intended. But Ashenden, unlike most professional humorists, had a kindly tolerance for other people's humor, and now he answered R on his own lines. "When would she like to see me, do you think?" he asked. "Give her my love, won't you?" Now R quite distinctly chuckled. Ashenden sighed. "She'll want to titivate a little before you come, I expect. You know what she is. She likes to make the best of herself. Shall we say 10:30? And then when you've had a talk to her, we might go out and lunch together somewhere." "All right," said Ashenden. "I'll come to the Lottie at 10:30. When Ashenden, clean and refreshed, reached the hotel, an orderly whom he recognized met him in the hall and took him up to R's apartment. He opened the door and showed Ashenden in. R was standing with his back to a bright log fire dictating to his secretary. "Sit down," said R, and went on with his dictation. It was a nicely furnished sitting room, and a bunch of roses in a bowl gave the impression of a woman's hand. On a large table was a litter of papers. R looked older than when last Ashenden had seen him. His thin yellow face was more lined, and his hair was grayer. The work was telling on him. He didn't spare himself. He was up at 7 every morning, and he worked late into the night. His uniform was spick and span, but he wore it shabbily. "That'll do," he said. "Take all this stuff away and get on with the typing. I'll sign before I go out to lunch." Then he turned to the orderly. "I don't want to be disturbed." The secretary, a sub-lieutenant in the 30s, obviously a civilian with a temporary commission, gathered up a mass of papers and left the room. As the orderly was following, R said, "Wait outside. If I want you, I'll call." "Very good, sir." When they were alone, R turned to Ashenden with what for him was cordiality. "Have a nice journey up?" "Yes, sir." "What do you think of this?" he asked, looking round the room. "Not bad, is it? I never see why one shouldn't do what one can to mitigate the hardships of war." While he was idly chatting, R gazed at Ashenden with a singular fixity. The stare of those pale eyes of his, too closely set together, gave you the impression that he looked at your naked brain and had a very poor opinion of what he saw there. R, in rare moments of expansion, made no secret of the fact that he looked upon his fellow men as fools or knaves. That was one of the obstacles he had to contend with in his calling. On the whole, he preferred them knaves. You knew then what you were up against, and could take steps accordingly. He was a professional soldier, and had spent his career in India and the colonies. At the outbreak of the war, he was stationed in Jamaica, and someone in the War Office who had had dealings with him, remembering him, brought him over and put him in the intelligence department. His astuteness was so great that he very soon occupied an important post. He had an immense energy and a gift for organization, no scruples, but resource, courage, and determination. He had perhaps but one weakness. Throughout his life, he had never come in contact with persons, especially women, of any social consequence. The only women he had ever known were the wives of his brother officers, the wives of government officials and of businessmen. And when coming to London at the beginning of the war, his work brought him into contact with brilliant, beautiful, and distinguished women, he was unduly dazzled. They made him feel shy, but he cultivated their society. He became quite a ladies' man. And to Ashenden, who knew more about him than R suspected, that bowl of roses told a story. Ashenden knew that R had not sent for him to talk about the weather and the crops, and wondered when he was coming to the point. He didn't wonder long. "You've been doing pretty well in Geneva," he said. "I'm glad you think that, sir," replied Ashenden. Suddenly R looked very cold and stern. He had done with idle talk. "I've got a job for you," he said. Ashenden made no reply, but he felt a happy little flutter somewhere about the pit of his stomach. "Have you ever heard of Chandra Lal?"
"No, sir."
A frown of impatience for an instant darkened the colonel's brow. He expected his subordinates to know everything he wished them to know. "Where have you been living all these years?" "At 36 Chesterfield Street, Mayfair," returned Ashenden. The shadow of a smile crossed R's yellow face. The somewhat impertinent reply was after his own sardonic heart. He went over to the big table and opened a dispatch case that lay upon it. He took out a photograph and handed it to Ashenden. "That's him." To Ashenden, unused to Oriental faces, it looked like any of 100 Indians that he had seen. It might have been the photograph of one or other of the Rajahs who came periodically to England and are portrayed in the illustrated papers. It showed a fat-faced, swarthy man with full lips and a fleshy nose. His hair was black, thick, and straight, and his very large eyes, even in the photograph, were liquid and cow-like. He looked ill at ease in European clothes. "Here he is in native dress," said R, giving Ashenden another photograph. This was full length, whereas the first had shown only the head and shoulders, and it had evidently been taken some years earlier. He was thinner, and his great, serious eyes seemed to devour his face. It was done by a native photographer in Calcutta, and the surroundings were naively grotesque. Chandra Lal stood against a background on which had been painted a pensive palm tree in a view of the sea. One hand rested on a heavily carved table on which was a rubber plant in a flower pot. But in his turban and long pale tunic, he was not without dignity. "What do you think of him?" asked R. "I should have said he was a man not without personality. There's a certain force there. Here's his dossier. Read it, will you?" R gave Ashenden a couple of typewritten pages, and Ashenden sat down. R put on his spectacles and began to read the letters that awaited his signature. Ashenden skimmed the report and then read it a second time more attentively. It appeared that Chandra Lal was a dangerous agitator. He was a lawyer by profession, but had taken up politics and was bitterly hostile to the British rule in India. He was a partisan of armed force and had been on more than one occasion responsible for riots in which life had been lost. He was once arrested, tried, and sentenced to 2 years imprisonment, but he was at liberty at the beginning of the war and, seizing his opportunity, began to foment active rebellion. He was at the heart of plots to embarrass the British in India and so prevent them from transferring troops to the seat of war, and with the help of immense sums given to him by German agents, he was able to cause a great deal of trouble. He was concerned in 2 or 3 bomb outrages, which, though beyond killing a few innocent bystanders, they did little harm, yet shook the nerves of the public and so damaged its morale. He evaded all attempts to arrest him. His activity was formidable. He was here and there. But the police could never lay hands on him, and they only learned that he'd been in some city when, having done his work, he had left it. At last, a high reward was offered for his arrest on a charge of murder, but he escaped the country, got to America, from there went to Sweden, and eventually reached Berlin. Here, he busied himself with schemes to create disaffection among the native troops that had been brought to Europe. All this was narrated dryly, without comment or explanation, but from the very frigidity of the narrative, you got a sense of mystery and adventure, of hairbreadth escapes and dangers dangerously encountered. The report ended as follows. C has a wife in India and two children. He's not known to have anything to do with women. He neither drinks nor smokes. He is said to be honest. Considerable sums of money have passed through his hands, and there has never been any question as to his not having made a proper use of them. He has undoubted courage and is a hard worker. He is said to pride himself on keeping his word. Ashenden returned the document to R. Well, a fanatic. Ashenden thought there was about the man something rather romantic and attractive, but he knew that R didn't want any nonsense of that sort from him. He looks like a very dangerous fellow. He is the most dangerous conspirator in or out of India. He's done more harm than all the rest of them put together. You know that there's a gang of these Indians in Berlin. Well, he's the brains of it. If he could be got out of the way, I could afford to ignore the others. He's the only one who has any guts. I've been trying to catch him for a year. I thought there wasn't a hope. But now, at last, I've got a chance, and by God, I'm going to take it. And what'll you do then? R chuckled grimly. Shoot him, and shoot him damn quick. Ashenden did not answer. R walked once or twice across the small room, and then, again with his back to the fire, faced Ashenden. His thin mouth was twisted by a sarcastic smile. Did you notice at the end of that report I gave you? It said he wasn't known to have anything to do with women. Well, that was true, but it isn't any longer. The damn fool has fallen in love. R stepped over to his dispatch case and took out a bundle tied up with pale blue ribbon. Look, here are his love letters. You're a novelist. It might amuse you to read them. In fact, you should read them. It'll help you to deal with the situation. Take them away with you. R flung the neat little bundle back into the dispatch case. One wonders how an able man like that can allow himself to get besotted over a woman. It was the last thing I ever expected of him. Ashenden's eyes traveled to that bowl of beautiful roses that stood on the table, but he said nothing. R, who missed little, saw the glance, and his look suddenly darkened. Ashenden knew that he felt like asking him what the devil he was staring at. At that moment, R had no friendly feelings towards his subordinate, but he made no remark. He went back to the subject on hand. Anyhow, that's neither here nor there. Chandra has fallen madly in love with a woman called Julia Lazzari. He's crazy about her. Do you know how he picked her up? Of course I do. She's a dancer, and she does Spanish dances, but she happens to be an Italian. For stage purposes, she calls herself La Malaguena. You know, the kind of thing. Popular Spanish music and a mantilla, a fan and a high comb. She's been dancing all over Europe for the last 10 years. Is she any good? No, rotten. She's been in the provinces in England, and she's had a few engagements in London. She never got more than £10 a week. Chandra met her in Berlin in a tingle-tangle. You know what that is, a cheap sort of music hall. I take it that on the continent she looked upon her dancing chiefly as a means to enhance her value as a prostitute. How did she get to Berlin during the war? She'd been married to a Spaniard at one time. I think she still is, though they don't live together, and she traveled on a Spanish passport. It appears Chandra made a dead set for her. R took up the Indian's photograph again and looked at it thoughtfully. You wouldn't have thought there was anything very attractive in that greasy little nigger. God, how they run to fat. The fact remains that she fell very nearly as much in love with him as he did with her. I've got her letters too, only copies, of course. He's got the originals, and I dare say he keeps them tied up in pink ribbon. She's mad about him. I'm not a literary man, but I think I know when a thing rings true. Anyhow, you'll be reading them, and you can tell me what you think. And then people say there's no such thing as love at first sight. R smiled with faint irony. He was certainly in a good humor this morning. But how did you get hold of all these letters? How did I get hold of them? How do you imagine? Owing to her Italian nationality, Giulia Lazzari was eventually expelled from Germany. She was put over the Dutch frontier. Having an engagement to dance in England, she was granted a visa and... R looked up a date among the papers. And on the 24th of October, last sailed from Rotterdam to Harwich. Since then, she's danced in London, Birmingham, Portsmouth, and other places. She was arrested a fortnight ago at Hull. What for? Espionage. She was transferred to London. I went to see her myself at Holloway. Ashenden and R looked at one another for a moment without speaking, and it may be that each was trying his hardest to read the other's thoughts. Ashenden was wondering where the truth in all this lay, and R wondered how much of it he could advantageously tell him. How did you get on to her? I thought it odd that the Germans should allow her to dance quietly in Berlin for weeks, and then for no particular reason decide to put her out of the country. It would be a good introduction for espionage, and a dancer who was not too careful of her virtue might make opportunities of learning things that it would be worth someone's while in Berlin to pay a good price for. I thought it might be as well to let her come to England and see what was up. I kept track of her. I discovered that she was sending letters to an address in Holland two or three times a week, and two or three times a week was receiving answers from Holland. Hers were written in a queer mixture of French, German, and English. She speaks English a little, and French quite well, but the answers were written entirely in English. It was good English, but not an Englishman's English, flowery and rather grandiloquent. I wondered who was writing them. They seemed to be just ordinary love letters, but they were by way of being rather hot stuff. It was plain enough that they were coming from Germany, and the writer was neither English, French, nor German. Why did he write in English? The only foreigners who know English better than any continental language are Orientals, and not Turks or Egyptians either. They know French. A Jap would write English, and so would an Indian. I came to the conclusion that Julia's lover was one of that gang of Indians that were making trouble for us in Berlin. I had no idea it was Chandra Lal till I found the photograph. How did you get that? She carried it about with her. It was a pretty good bit of work, that. She kept it locked up in her trunk with a lot of theatrical photographs of comic singers and clowns and acrobats. It might easily have passed for the picture of some music hall artiste in his stage dress. In fact, later, when she was arrested and asked who the photograph represented, she said she didn't know. It was an Indian conjurer who had given it to her, and she had no idea what his name was. Anyhow, I put a very smart lad on the job, and he thought it queer that it should be the only photograph in the lot that came from Calcutta. He noticed that there was a number on the back, and he took it, the number I mean. Of course, the photograph was replaced in the box. By the way, just as a matter of interest, how did your very smart lad get at the photograph at all? R's eyes twinkled. That's none of your business. But I don't mind telling you that he was a good-looking boy. Anyhow, it's of no consequence. When we got the number of the photograph, we cabled to Calcutta, and in a little while I received the grateful news that the object of Julia's affections was no less a person than the incorruptible Chandra Lal. Then I thought it my duty to have Julia watched a little more carefully. She seemed to have a sneaking fondness for naval officers. I couldn't exactly blame her for that. They are attractive. But it's unwise for ladies of easy virtue and doubtful nationality to cultivate their society in wartime. Presently, I got a very pretty little body of evidence against her. How was she getting her stuff through? She wasn't getting it through. She wasn't trying to. The Germans had turned her out quite genuinely. She wasn't working for them. She was working for Chandra. After her engagement was through in England, she was planning to go to Holland again and meet him. She wasn't very clever at the work. She was nervous, but it looked easy. No one seemed to bother about her. It grew rather exciting. She was getting all sorts of interesting information without any risk. In one of her letters, she said, "I have so much to tell you, mon petit chou, darling, and what you will be extrêmement intéressé to know," and she underlined the French words. R paused and rubbed his hands together. His tired face bore a look of devilish enjoyment of his own cunning. It was espionage made easy. Of course I didn't care a damn about her. It was him I was after. Well, as soon as I'd got the goods on her, I arrested her. I had enough evidence to convict a regiment of spies. R put his hands in his pockets, and his pale lips twisted to a smile that was almost a grimace. Holloway's not a very cheerful place, you know. I imagine no prison is, remarked Ashenden. I left her to stew in her own juice for a week before I went to see her. She was in a very pretty state of nerves by then. The wardress told me she'd been in violent hysterics most of the time. I must say she looked like the devil. Is she handsome? You'll see for yourself. She's not my type. I dare say she's better when she's made up and that kind of thing. I talked to her like a Dutch uncle. I put the fear of God into her. I told her she'd get 10 years. I think I scared her. I know I tried to. Of course she denied everything, but the proofs were there. I assured her she hadn't got a chance. I spent 3 hours with her. She went all the pieces, and at last she confessed everything. Then I told her that I'd let her go scot-free if she'd get Chandra to come to France. She absolutely refused. She said she'd rather die. She was very hysterical and tiresome, but I let her rave. I told her to think it over and said I'd see her in a day or two, and we'd have another talk about it. In point of fact, I left her for a week. She'd evidently had time to reflect, because when I came again, she asked me quite calmly what it was exactly that I proposed. She'd been in jail a fortnight then, and I expect she'd had about enough of it. I put it to her as plainly as I could, and she accepted. "I don't think I quite understand," said Ashenden. "Don't you? I should have thought it was clear to the meanest intelligence. If she can get Chandra to cross the Swiss frontier and come into France, she's to go free, either to Spain or to South America, with her passage paid. And how the devil is she to get Chandra to do that? He's madly in love with her. He's longing to see her. His letters are almost crazy. She's written to him to say that she can't get a visa to Holland. I told you she was to join him there when their tour was over. But she can get one for Switzerland. That's a neutral country, and he's safe there. He jumped at the chance. They've arranged to meet at Lausanne." "Yes. When he reaches Lausanne, he'll get a letter from her to say that the French authorities won't let her cross the frontier and that she's going to Tonon, which is just on the other side of the lake from Lausanne, in France, and she's going to ask him to come there." "What makes you think he will?" R paused for an instant. He looked at Ashton with a pleasant expression. "She must make him if she doesn't want to go to penal servitude for 10 years. "I see. She's arriving from England this evening in custody, and I should like you to take her down to Tonon by the night train." "Me?" said Ashenden. "Yes, I thought of the sort of job you could manage very well. Presumably you know more about human nature than most people. It'll be a pleasant change for you to spend a week or two at Tonon. I believe it's a pretty little place, fashionable too, in peacetime. You might take the baths there." "And what do you expect me to do when I get the lady down to Tonon?" "I leave you a free hand. I've made a few notes that may be useful to you. I'll read them to you, shall I?" Ashenden listened attentively. R's plan was simple and explicit. Ashenden could not but feel unwilling admiration for the brain that has so neatly devised it. Presently, R suggested that they should have luncheon, and he asked Ashenden to take him to some place where they could see smart people. It amused Ashenden to see R so sharp, sure of himself and alert in his office, seized as he walked into a restaurant with shyness. He talked a little too loud in order to show that he was at his ease, and made himself somewhat unnecessarily at home. You saw in his manner the shabby and commonplace life he had led till the hazards of war raised him to a position of consequence. He was glad to be in that fashionable restaurant, cheek by jowl with persons who bore great or distinguished names, but he felt like a schoolboy in his first top hat, and he quailed before the steely eye of the maître d'hôtel. His quick glance darted here and there, and his sallow face beamed with a self-satisfaction of which he was slightly ashamed. Ashenden drew his attention to an ugly woman in black, with a lovely figure, wearing a long row of pearls. "That is Madame de Bride. She's the mistress of the Grand Duke Theodore. She's probably one of the most influential women in Europe. She's certainly one of the cleverest." R's clever eyes rested on her, and he flushed a little. "By George, this is life," he said. Ashenden watched him curiously. Luxury is dangerous to people who've never known it, and to whom its temptations are held out too suddenly. R, that shrewd, cynical man, was captivated by the vulgar glamour and the shoddy brilliance of the scene before him. Just as the advantage of culture is that it enables you to talk nonsense with distinction, so the habit of luxury allows you to regard its frills and fourbelows with a proper contumely. But when they had eaten their luncheon and were drinking their coffee, Ashenden, seeing that R was mellowed by the good meal and his surroundings, went back to the subject that was in his thoughts. "That Indian fellow must be a rather remarkable chap," he said. "He's got brains, of course." One can't help being impressed by a man who had the courage to take on almost single-handed the whole British power in India. I wouldn't get sentimental about him if I were you. He's nothing but a dangerous criminal. I don't suppose he'd use bombs if he could command a few batteries and a half a dozen battalions. He uses what weapons he can. You can hardly blame him for that. After all, he's aiming at nothing for himself, is he? He's aiming at freedom for his country. On the face of it, it looks as though he were justified in his actions." But R had no notion of what Ashenden was talking. "That's very far-fetched and morbid," he said. "We can't go into all that. Our job is to get him, and when we've got him, to shoot him." "Of course. He's declared war, and he must take his chance. I shall carry out your instructions. That's what I'm here for. But I see no harm in realizing that there's something to be admired and respected in him." R was once more the cool and astute judge of his fellows. "I've not yet made up my mind whether the best men for this kind of job are those who do it with passion or those who keep their heads. Some of them are filled with hatred for the people we're up against, and when we down them it gives them a sort of satisfaction like satisfying a personal grudge. Of course, they're very keen on their work. You're different, aren't you? You look at it like a game of chess, and you don't seem to have any feeling one way or the other. I can't quite make it out. Of course, for some sort of jobs, it's just what one wants." He called for the bill and walked back with R to the hotel.